Are you still searching for your perfect place to call home? Well, now is the time to buy at Fisher Homes. If you're looking to move in before the end of 2024, May could be your last opportunity to start building your dream home and close before the year's end. If you're hoping to move in even sooner, Fisher Homes also has homes that are move-in ready and waiting for you, where you can start enjoying the benefits of homeownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with a new home advisor today at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home.
Had enough of those supplements that leave you feeling nothing? Symbiotica is your solution to great-tasting, all-natural supplements that actually work. Crafted with premium plant-based ingredients, their products have no seed oils, fillers, or artificial nonsense. It's just pure goodness in every pouch. Try them out and actually feel the difference today. Visit Symbiotica.com and use code IHEART for 15% off plus free shipping on your subscription order. Again, that's 15% off plus free shipping on your subscription order. Go to Symbiotica.com. That's Symbiotica.
Now I'd like to introduce you to Meaningful Beauty, the famed skincare brand created by iconic supermodel Cindy Crawford. It's her secret to absolutely gorgeous skin. Meaningful Beauty makes powerful and effective skincare simple, and it's loved by millions of women. It's formulated for all ages and all skin tones and types, and it's designed to work as a complete skincare system, leaving your skin feeling soft, smooth, and nourished. I recommend starting with Cindy's full regimen, which contains all five of her best-selling products, including the amazing Youth-Activating Melon Serum. This next-generation serum has the power of melon leaf stem cell technology. It's melon leaf stem cells encapsulated for freshness and released onto the skin to support a visible reduction in the appearance of wrinkles. With thousands of glowing five-star reviews, why not give it a try? Subscribe today and you can get the amazing Meaningful Beauty System for just $49.95. That includes our introductory five-piece system, free gifts, free shipping, and a 60-day money-back guarantee. All that available at MeaningfulBeauty.com. With every CBD product claiming to do something different, it's nearly impossible to decide what's best for you. Lazarus Naturals pioneered the farm-to-front-door model of transparency where they handle each step of the production process to ensure quality, potency, and consistency. Scannable labels allow you to see the test results of your hemp batch so you can be confident in the safety and quality. Visit LazarusNaturals.com today. Lazarus Naturals, committed to improving your life as well as the world around you. Not available in Idaho, Iowa, or South Dakota.
Oh, hi, hello there. I am Liv, and this is Let's Talk About Myths, Baby. And I am here with yet another conversation episode, and as always, questioning why I sing the title of my podcast. Now, let me just say that there is a little wild coincidence happening in this episode, and that is aside from the fact that it was just, like, seriously fun and genuinely hilarious to record. So I spoke with Jerome Ruddick, who's studying his PhD at Newcastle University in the UK, and he told me everything I didn't know that I needed to know about material culture and real-life humans interacting with their mythology during the Hellenistic period of ancient Greece, but specifically in regions in Arcadia, on Crete, and even in the Phoenician city of Tyre, which was ruled by Hellenistic Greeks at the time. We recorded this episode ages ago, actually, like before I even went to Greece. Probably we recorded it in, like, I want to say March, maybe it was April. It was a good long time ago, but I had so many episodes recorded at that time that it's just now coming out. And what do you know, we even briefly mentioned how Aphrodite has origins in the Phoenician goddess Astarte. What are the chances? I love it. And Jerome talks about how she's not alone. The Phoenician hero Melkart also gets major ties to the Greek hero, obviously, Heracles, particular during this period. Absolutely fascinating. Anyway, it was super fun, super fascinating. Jerome was fucking hilarious and called Pausanias Big P multiple times as though that was just like the only thing to call him. And frankly, it's just become one of my favorite things, you know? So here we are. Conversations not to have a go at Big P, Pausanias, material culture in the Hellenistic period with Jerome Ruddick. I really was excited about the topic you presented because I obviously know Greek mythology like the back of my hand, like really know the stories like far too well at this point, I think.
You probably know it better than I do, to be honest, actually. I'd imagine you know it a lot better than I do.
I don't try to hold back on my knowledge at this point. It is kind of excessive, the stuff that lives in my brain. But one of the things that I don't know that much about is like actual daily like life when it comes to this stuff, you know, like I know the sources and I know the stories, but one of the things that's so exciting about what you kind of proposed is this way of kind of talking about it in relation to the actual humans of that world. So like, why don't you just start by telling me like a little bit about what you study in when it comes to that and kind of, yeah, really anything you want to say, but sort of an introduction on what you do.
Oh, okay. So I'm studying Greek mythology, but I'm studying it in relation to identity and material culture. So it's how the two function with one another, and how not only Greek mythology contributes to Greek identity, but how material culture is this like really important factor in allowing these myths to find root in these Greek communities and kind of make them more tangible, more kind of verifiable, you know, like really build them into Greek society. And that's really what I'm doing. And I'm looking at three communities as we do so at the moment, which will expand later. And that's Crete, a place in Arcadia called Lygisura, and the Phoenician and some of the Phoenicians Tyre on the Levantine coast.
Ooh, so
a nice little
that's very exciting.
Geographical mix.
Yeah. Okay. I now already have so many questions and you've literally said like two things. But first, I think so because obviously like my show is really for just like any old person who wants to learn about this stuff, which is the best part. But can you just like give a quick explanation about like what material culture entails?
Yeah, absolutely. So material culture is, it's really quite simple, actually. All the scholars try to make it sound complicated, but it's not. It's material culture. It's cups. It's pots. It's sculpture. It's like pediments on temples, stuff like that. Everything's material culture. A spoon is material culture.
So anything just like physical, yeah.
Pretty much. Honestly, pretty much. Yeah, that's it.
Yeah.
Cloves could be a type of material culture too. So yeah.
yeah. Okay. That's the thing. Like I've been learning more and more about that. And thankfully I get guests to come on and talk about that kind of thing. But like, that's the kind of stuff that's so hard to sort of research on your own, which is why I love having these conversations. But like, it does really impact so much about like the actual people like living these lives. Anyway, I'm clearly getting excited already. And I'm so yes, please tell me more about any of those places or any of these things or literally anything.
Well, the first thing I wanted to start on, actually, you mentioned a point just about how it's hard to research material culture. I agree with that because the first time I started the research into this topic, I ended up reading this really strange book about, it was about classical sculpture, but it was from, I think it was from the 1930s or something. And it was a little bit 1930s-ish, you know, they really love the Greeks, but not like we love Greeks, like in a kind of weird, like colonial type way. It was a bit dodgy. And I was reading this book going, what am I reading here? This is a bit funky. And I had to throw that aside. So that's kind of where you end up when you start looking at material culture. You're like, oh no, sculpture, and you get some weird factors. I don't blame you. Basically,
yeah, like, especially the 1930s, like that's the time period where they're like revering them as if they're just like the absolute most,
the pinnacle of human
everything.
Civilization.
Yeah, exactly. Like that just comes along with so much like, like the Greeks are amazing, but like let's not pretend they're better than anyone else.
But, yeah, they're good, but they're like 70% good, not 100% good. You know what I mean? Like,
exactly.
They're a good, fun, you know, middle ground good.
Yeah.
I'm slacking off the Greeks now. Like I love the Greeks. I should be doing that.
I mean, I do it too. And it's my entire career to love them. So we can also criticize. That's the whole point of like, yeah, I think it's important.
It's reason, debate, discussion. Yeah. So what was the question now? Cause I've lost it.
I mean, honestly, also I love doing this is like, just let your brain go. It's fine. I have ADHD. It goes everywhere.
Me too.
But yeah. Yeah, and I'm
ADHD,
also like
ADHD siblings. Yeah.
Oh, I mean, honestly, there's a lot of people in classics who have ADHD. It's kind of nice because I don't feel like my brain is gonna throw everybody off. But I'm also like newly on medication, and I'm like, we'll see how anything works. as I
have questions about that, but I won't interrupt the podcast of that. I have questions about that because I've been anyway. Please go.
No, but I get all that interest. My God. But yeah. So I mean, honestly, like, I just want to hear anything. So my question was was really just like, talk about anything. But I'm excited about all those regions, but I also don't want to like jump from one or like. Anyway, I'm getting too excited.
Let's start with them. Let's start with a very brief overview. I'll do Like Asura first because it's kind of my favorite at the moment. It's what I think I know the most about, which is helpful to stop me from pausing and inerring. So Like Asura, so it's, you know, Arcadia. Hopefully everyone's familiar with that because there's so many good stories from Arcadia. Mm-hmm. So in the region of Arcadia, around sort of about the central area, a little bit closer towards Sparta, sort of that, it's hard to do without a map, but hopefully people are going to put up their phones and look at that. But there's a town called Like Asura, and it's near this town called Megalopolis, which becomes very important. Because about, what is it again? I think it's 368 BC, right? Megalopolis kind of go crazy and they want to take over everything. They're like, we're going to take over these towns. So they get all the sanctuaries and either they destroy them or kind of take their sanctuary bits and like collate them into Megalopolis. So then Megalopolis is basically the sort of cosmopolitan hub for all the sanctuaries. But the interesting bit is when we read the ancient sources, like Asura should have been destroyed too because it's really close to Megalopolis. But it isn't. It stays alive for some reason. Like, its sanctuary is intact. Its town's intact. Mm. The Like Asura are having fun and things are good. and they say, Pausanias says in the sources, he's the main one we have sources about for this. He's like, oh yeah, Like Asura survived because of Despoina, their local goddess, who the Megaloplins are like, oh yeah, they're nice. Oh, we like her. She's cool. And they let them live. So it's really fascinating because suddenly you're like, oh my God, myth saved them. Their mythology literally saved them from being, well, destroyed in the worst case.
I also just love the idea that like a place called Megalopolis is like going to take over everything. Like, I feel like with that name, it's like, well, that was bound to happen.
Well, I think to be fair, I think they may have created the name because they were taking over everything. Smaller Lopolis before. And then when they started taking over, like, I'm going to change it to Midalopolis and then became Megalopolis.
There you go. Nice. Yeah, you got to make it work, right? It's like, just convince everyone that you're the biggest by calling yourself that.
Yeah, no, to be fair, well, you know what they say, like, what was it again? Fake it till you make it. And apparently they made it eventually. Yeah. So, you know, they got there.
Yeah. So Despoina is so interesting because I've done like some really base level research on, like, I don't even know if I've researched necessarily her, but the word is also often used as an epithet, isn't it? Like, So it's really interesting. It's like both a goddess and an epithet. So it can be used along with like other goddesses, but then as a physical, or not physical obviously, but as like an actual technical goddess, is she really specific to that area of Arcadia?
Oh, she is. Not offhand, I appreciate, like, you're very shit hot on your stuff, which I should have expected, but like, you know. Yeah, beautiful. She is. She's very specific. So basically, this is interesting. Despoina is supposed to be, we think, Persephone, Persephone, goddess of springtime and all that Hades stuff. So apparently it's another form of her, right? But they call it Despoina, and it's a bit of a mix whether or not that's supposed to be like a sort of cultic, like, mysteries, Eleusinian mysteries name for her, or something else. But it's supposed to translate to the mistress. And Pausanias in his text also goes, we don't know her real name, and no one says it. You know, like, so it's getting really mysterious and kind of a little bit like, I don't know the word I'm looking, I don't know what good word I'm looking for. Kind of sexy, like, ooh, you know, it's really kind of titillating. but no, it is a very specific name to Despoina. She is very, very specific to Arcadia. I think there are some references of her, and I think it's like on some of the smaller Greek islands, but it's pretty rare. It's not not universal. No. She is absolutely like a Syrian goddess, an Arcadian goddess. She's very specific to the region.
Yeah.
She's very cool.
So, okay. Here's more of my like deeply niche and unspecific knowledge. That's really contradictory regardless. So when I was last in Athens at the archaeological museum, they have this thing there. I'm sure you know what I'm talking about because it's
I have an idea, but please go ahead. Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm going to try to like describe it, but it's basically, it's marble, but it's a like marble rendition of like a piece of clothing. And it's incredible. Yeah. It's like all these folds and like, it's unbelievable, and it's all about her, and like there's so many things on it. So is that like, you clearly know what I'm talking about, obviously, because it's amazing, but is that something you've studied specifically? Because I would love to know more about it.
Yes, it is something I study specifically.
Also,
in fact,
I forget what it's called.
It's called Despoina's Veil, or the Veil of Despoina, and it would have been attached to the back of her. I'm miming this, but I know no one can see it, so just picture me miming it. There's a veil coming out the back of her head, and this is literally what the main thing I've studied, so I can tell you quite a lot about it if
Amazing.
You want.
Please, because also I can share pictures of it when I share the episode, because I took somebody, I forget who it was, but somebody on Twitter, like Classics Twitter, like asked me or just put out a call being like, I need pictures of this. And I was like, I'm going to the Archaeological Museum like tomorrow. I can take them. So
I have pictures too. To the point, I was there taking pictures of it, and the people in the museum were staring at me weirdly because I'd been there for 10 minutes taking pictures. And I was like, I looked at them, and my wife came up to me as well, and she was like, you need to stop taking pictures because I think they think you're like planting a bomb or something on the veil.
So good. Yeah, I took like every single angle. I think I have like 20 pictures of that piece.
Absolutely, you need to, because it's so intricate. Yeah. It's really it's cool. I'll tell you about it. I'll tell you the most interesting thing I think about it. I think the most interesting thing about this, and this is coming from, this is not entirely on me, this is from a scholar called Plamidus, I believe. Plamidus, who basically did most of the legwork as far as I can tell about this. But basically, it looks like the cult group in general, the whole cult group of Despoina, but particularly the Veil, it looks like it's like collated mythologies from across the Arcadian region, right? So it's stuff like there's Zeus, there's Poseidon, Epeus, there's zoomorphic images, so like hybrid figures, like, you know, half human, half animal, and it seems to have collected all these Arcadian myths, all these local Arcadian myths, and put them on this veil. And it's really interesting why they've done that. And I've got some opinions. I'll share that in like a separate bit, but I've got some opinions on why. But it's really fascinating. So they use material culture basically to get all these myths and kind of shove them into like Asura. So like Asura is kind of a sort of a patron, a holder, a guardian of all of them, which is, well, I think you only really see it at Asclepius. They usually like collate loads of mythologies there, but otherwise don't know if I've seen that happen anywhere else. I'm sure there's someone listening who goes, oh, there's tons, you're a fool, you haven't, but you know, I don't know too much
about ancient Greece. It's fine. We can't know everything.
It's a big country, you know, and they spread out so far that you have to look at like half of Asia before you can really know the Greek stuff. So.
Yeah, that piece is so incredible too, because like I'm sure it wasn't necessarily unique in the ancient world, but in terms of what survives, it's fairly unique in the way that it is so incredibly detailed, like you're saying, featuring all of these different myths and like characters and things and just like one like marble piece of fabric.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is. They've really gone overboard. But one of the most interesting bits about it, to give everyone like a visual picture, is there is along the bottom there's a string of dancing animals, like half human, half animal figures dancing. They think they're dancing in festivals. They're playing like bagpipe. They're not bagpipes. Not playing that. Not Scottish. I don't think the Greeks had those. I think we can reliably say they're playing flutes and such. And they're dancing around lyres and flutes. And it looks like basically it's an image of festival. So it's looking like Asura. Or maybe may have had like a regional festival which they had took place in like Asura. We don't know as well, because the town is basically gone. They haven't found any evidence for it. Like, we know it exists because there's some work by a few very talented scholars who have apparently looked at the rocks or the mountains around and be like, oh, I can see there was a town there. And I'm looking at it going, I mean I consider myself an archaeologist. I had to sit in a muddy field and dig for 2 years, but I'm like, I can't see that. But anyway, they did, and apparently there was a town, and it may have happened in that town, but we can't find the town, so we don't know if it happened. It does look like a festival happened, based on what the veil says, because of the dancing animals, which is super cool. There's like some sort of like magic festival going on, which we don't know about. That's interesting.
I mean, God, like, there's just so much stuff like this where you're like, just this thing that like maybe was a thing, but we have no proof of it. But what if it was? And it would super cool if it was. Like, it's like half of ancient Greece, and I fucking love it.
It's a mystery box. Greece is a mystery box. There's so much.
That's why it's the best. Yeah,
I agree.
I love that, and I love that I could remember that piece so well. But like,
A+. Like, I mean, I don't want to sound like, you know, I mean, like, yeah, I'm, yeah, it's funny.
It's like, I'll, like, if I learn a thing once about ancient Greece, it tends to stick in my head forever. Nothing that I need on a daily basis, but ancient Greece, yeah, it sticks.
That's really lucky though, because I learn something about Greece 10 times and it doesn't stick in my head. And then I make a note on it. And then I start. The only reason I remember this stuff is I've been doing it for 3 years now.
Yeah.
And even then it took it to the second year for me to really be like, oh, I can recall this at will. You know,
so exciting. Yeah. Yeah. So, okay. Is there any other pieces from that area that are, I mean, I don't know if anything's quite as interesting as that particular piece, but like when it comes to that, like material culture of that region?
Not of avail, but of zoomorphic type images. There is from, my Greek really sucks. I'm going to butcher this name. And
I don't know Greek at all. So.
Figalia. I think it's Philgea or Figalia. One of those. It's in the Arcadia again, but it's got, they call it Black Demeter, and it's because apparently she's supposed to have the head of a goat. So very Arcadian, really, because Arcadia is also the place where they were supposed to have made Pan as well, you know, the god of the wild. I just learned of Pan from Percy Jackson. That's where I first met him, to be honest. So it's very Arcadian. These hybrid figures are super Arcadian. You see them other places too. I'm not going to pretend they're completely unique, but they're pretty Arcadian. You know, it's a real staple of Arcadian mythology to have hybrid figures.
Well, and Arcadia is like the whole, I mean, it's like kind of the center of the Peloponnese, right? And that it's just very wild, and like, I feel like it's the place, right? It's also one of the places where Atalanta was like raised by bears in the mythology. Like, it's just one of those places that it doesn't surprise me that it would be sort of the most heavily associated with animals and wildlife and all of that stuff.
I mean, Zeus was also supposed to be raised in Mount Lycaon, but of course the Cretans would have something to say about that, because they'll be like,
and like a handful of
exactly. And everyone else who's claimed that Zeus was born in their house somewhere, they're like, no, Zeus was born here, he's our patron god. You know?
Yeah, there's like five mountains that say that that's where Zeus was raised, and I love mean,
to be fair, maybe Zeus was just a very big child and he covered all these mountains.
Yeah,
I don't know.
He just went everywhere.
Bits of him, or he, I don't know, he's all clay. or maybe Zeus had like four twin brothers, and then like, you know, well, not twins at that point, four identical brothers, then maybe he ate them all like Kronos. I don't know. Who knows?
Yeah.
It's probably more just the Greeks being the Greeks, which frankly is, we like this, we're gonna take it and put it in our culture. It's like, does that make sense? Doesn't have to. We don't care, you know.
Like, enter Heracles, who went literally everywhere and did things in every different city because everyone wanted a piece of him.
Yeah, well, literally, and he had so many kids because all the women all the women and men wanted a piece of him. So,
he just had to be everywhere. Yeah,
absolutely. I will say a last bit about Arcadia. Mm. And this is me basically plugging the research that I'm doing and what I think is interesting. So I think my pet theory. I think some others share bits and pieces of this, but I think this is relatively unique to me, as much as it can be, and stuff like this where everyone's done it. Everything. So basically, it's the idea that this Lycosera cult group basically was created by this. There's two interpretations. One, it was created by Megalopolis. That's the boring one. I don't like that. I like the one that Lycosera created it, because it's more a plucky underdog style. It's the idea that Megalopolis is basically taking over all these communities, and they let Lycosera stay alive. Great. But it seems that Lycosera may have commissioned this artist called Damathon to come along about, when is it again? I think it's 198 BC or like a. It was a 250. It's about like second to first century. He comes along, right, and he builds this statue for them. And I'm thinking they used it to try and retain like autonomies in their identity. So they were like, okay, we're still alive. That's great. If we collect all these mythologies, you know, we collect these mythologies from all the regional place, not only can we increase our own status, but we can also give ourselves like a new, fresh, powerful identity to combat the kind of the pull of Megalopolis, the control and influence of Megalopolis. And it's kind of how they established autonomy in the region by taking a statue, you know, collecting all the myths in the material culture. So using it basically as like a sort of mini Bible almost, you know, to like have all these myths in one place. And then capitalize on that to basically stay alive against Megalopolis, which is, I think, is a fascinating, if it is true, which we would never know unless a new source comes out with some guy going, so we created the statue because we wanted to, which won't ever happen. But I don't know if it is true. I imagine every day. I imagine that I'm the one who finds it, so I get to take credit. it's fascinating. It's this really great idea based, this plucky underdog trying to survive against the lure of this really powerful city, and they're using mythology to do it. That's how they get their significance power, identity. It's how they survive. And that's fucking cool, is what I think.
Well, and okay, so I really don't have a good grasp on Greek history after the classical period, because I've focused all of my interest on archaic and classical. But it's interesting to me that all of this was happening so late too, because I don't know, I always just imagine the Hellenistic period as like just all these kind of big powers across the whole of the Greek world taking control, versus having this idea of like a city in Arcadia trying to take control of like the rest of Arcadia. But I don't know anything what was happening in the Peloponnese at that time. But is it like somewhat unique, or like what was the deal there?
You know, it's not really unique actually, because as when we go into Crete, you're about to hear exactly the same sort of story. Right. basically Alexander the Great dies, obviously, and then everyone goes insane trying to take over his empire. Because why can't we all just be friends and be like, you can take that bit and you can take that bit? Oh, well. But, you know, so you get all these Hellenistic kings that pop up instead, because Alexander's given them the model for, oh, kingship. That's a good idea. Well, that's a good idea for one person, not for most people. And then basically you get expanded cities all over the place. I mean, it's more complicated than that. And I can't remember off the top of my head. And some Hellenistic expert on this is going to come along and say I'm an idiot. But yeah, loads of kings, loads of expansion. Basically, it's like the Greek world. It's like getting like a completed, it's like getting a glass and like thrown it on the ground, it shatters. It's sort of like the Greek world, it just goes into pieces and everyone starts fighting for themselves. So this idea of megalopolis taking over and then a city trying to, in my interpretation anyway, trying to rebel against it, isn't actually atypical for this period, really. You know what I mean? I can't think of exact examples, but no, this, you're probably going to see more of it if you did your research.
Yeah. I've had people on to talk about Hellenistic period, or maybe just one, but it was more so about like the kingdoms in the east and everything too. So I just realized. I have like no grasp on what was actually happening on like the Greek mainland during the Hellenistic period, which is kind of sad, but I mean, I like the classical, but then I get people on to talk about Hellenistic and then that's interesting too.
Hey, that's fine. I mean, to be honest, before I started down this avenue, I liked the classical too as well. And then I was, I remember I got told, don't do the classical, everyone does it. Do the Hellenistic. So I was like, oh, okay, fine, I'll do the Hellenistic. And I was like, wait a second, this is really interesting. Yeah. Why is no one doing this?
Are you still searching for your perfect place to call home? Well, now is the time to buy at Fisher Homes. If you're looking to move in before the end of 2024, May could be your last opportunity to start building your dream home and close before the year's end. If you're hoping to move in even sooner, Fisher Homes also has homes that are move-in ready and waiting for you, where you can start enjoying the benefits of homeownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with a new home advisor today at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home.
Had enough of those supplements that leave you feeling nothing? Symbionica is your solution to great-tasting, all-natural supplements that actually work. Crafted with premium plant-based ingredients, their products have no seed oils, fillers, or toxins. Try them out and actually feel the difference today. Visit Symbionica.com and use code IHEART for 15% off plus free shipping on your subscription order. Again, that's 15% off plus free shipping on your subscription order. Go to Symbionica.com. Symbiotica.com.
Now I'd like to introduce you to Meaningful Beauty, the famed skincare brand created by iconic supermodel Cindy Crawford. It's her secret to absolutely gorgeous skin. Meaningful Beauty makes powerful and effective skincare simple, and it's loved by millions of women. It's formulated for all ages and all skin tones and types, and it's designed to work as a complete skincare system, leaving your skin feeling soft, smooth, and nourished. I recommend starting with Cindy's full regimen, which contains all five of her best-selling products, including the amazing Youth Activating Melon Serum. This next generation serum has the power of melon leaf stem cell technology. It's melon leaf stem cells encapsulated for freshness and released onto the skin to support a visible reduction in the appearance of wrinkles. With thousands of glowing five-star reviews, why not give it a try? Subscribe today and you can get the amazing Meaningful Beauty System for just $49.95. That includes our introductory five-piece system, free gifts, free shipping, and a 60-day money-back guarantee. All of that available at MeaningfulBeauty.com. With every CBD product claiming to do something different, it's nearly impossible to decide what's best for you. Lazarus Naturals pioneered the farm-to-front-door model of transparency, where they handle each step of the production process to ensure quality, potency, and consistency. Scannable labels allow you to see the test results of your hemp batch so you can be confident in the safety and quality.
Visit LazarusNaturals.com today. Lazarus Naturals, committed to improving your life as well as the world around you. Not available in Idaho, Iowa, or South Dakota.
Because it, yeah, I mean, classical is very sort of like quintessential. It's like what you think of when you imagine ancient.
It's the classical. It's the classic period of Greece.
Exactly. Quite funny classic. Enough. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, yeah, I love learning more about it. And I was, like, Arcadia too kind of just like goes under the radar, you know?
It does.
Especially
yeah.
like when you like the classical period because it's just sort of there. But I did learn, I mean, when I was covering Sparta recently, it was interesting to learn how much Arcadia kind of really kept itself sort of separate from the whole mythology of the rest of the Peloponnese, who were all like, you know, we're Dorians, whereas the Arcadians were like, no, we are Arcadian. Like, we have been here since, is it like they say they've been there since like before the moon or something cool like that?
They do. Well, they do. Pausanias says like Lycosura is the oldest city in existence, which,
amazing.
I mean, you know, probably, not to have a go at Big P, but it's probably not true. Like, the oldest city of all time, probably not. But actually, there is archaeological evidence that they were around since the prehistoric times.
Wow, so, cool.
Really? So actually, he probably wasn't entirely wrong. They were probably really old. Older cities, maybe a little bit of a stretch. But he got excited. You know him. He just gets excited. He goes around, writes all this stuff down.
I like the idea of a guy from like first century, is it around that, first century CE, being I know what's the oldest. Yeah. Like, they've been around 2,000 years, so they're the oldest city ever.
I imagine, whenever I picture Pausanias, I always imagine he goes around, he's talking to the locals, and he has some old guys like, oh, that's the oldest city ever. And he's like, oh, really? And writes it down diligently. Yeah. And it's like, yeah, but come on, man, that guy's drunk, Pausanias. You can't trust him. You know, like...
Also, like, dude, there can only be one if you're saying it's actually the oldest. Whereas I can imagine him being like, these guys say they're the oldest and these guys say they're the oldest. And just like,
who's correct? And he's like, I don't care. I'm just going to write both of them down as the oldest.
Exactly. I also do have to focus on you calling him Big P. So thank you for bestowing that upon me.
I had to be fair, because I've realized the more and more work I do in this, the more I realize I'm completely reliant on Pausanias. So I'm going, you know what? You know, you could do all the scholarly, oh, well, we can't, he's not blah, blah, reliable. But nah, you know what? You give us a lot of good stuff. So, you know.
Yes.
Yeah, Big P. He deserves his nickname.
He absolutely does. I did not know nearly enough about him. I swear I've only really been, like, learning about him for the past less than a year. Because I just happen to have had a bunch of guests on, like, unintentionally, who are just super into Pausanias. And now I'm just kind of obsessed with him broadly. But I recently learned, and I think it'll be fine and it'll air before this episode, I'm just thinking about my timeline, but like, I recently learned that we didn't even know his name until like so many hundreds of years later, and like that's fascinating. He just kind of was this enigma, but turns out he's so helpful.
No, I know, that is amazing. And to be honest with you, I won't lie, I'm not going to pretend I know everything. I don't know as much about Pausanias as I should, so I'm going to rely on what the other people and you know. So yes, I'm sure we did. I didn't actually know we didn't know his name, actually. I looked at his work and not his history, but wow, yeah. Okay, that's interesting.
I know. I had no idea. So yeah, I had a guest on to talk about like Greece during the Roman period. And so he kind of went more into detail on Pausanias. Yeah. And like, it's really wild how much he sort of was like not a helpful source or not like utilized as a source until like maybe only like 300 years ago, and just sort of was super unknown. And then we come along and we're like, wait, this is actually so helpful, because like turns out this guy just walked around, asked questions and wrote them down. And how fucking cool is that?
Yeah. Well, to be fair, I need to, I need to say one thing about Romans. They're jolly come late, I believe is what. So I've got my supervisor, that's where he called him. He said he muttered to himself, jolly come late, rotten jolly. So I always remembered that. So that was quite funny. But Pausanias, I always imagine, like, when I think about these old scholars, writers, historians, I love the idea that Pausanias may have been dotting around doing this thing, and everyone's like, we don't care, Pausanias, who gives a crap, you know, whatever. And then us later are like, he is a godsend, because he's like the only one who survives. He's the only work we've got. So we're like, he's amazing. Whereas obviously, I don't know if there was like a geographical community and everyone was like spitting on his work. Oh, Pausanias, he said that city was the oldest one, and that one was, and he has no idea what he's talking about. And there's like some great guy called like Derek the Greek, and he's got like a really beautiful, like, really well-researched piece of work, but obviously we've lost it, so we've just got like crappy Pausanias, You know what I mean? And then I'm not to have a go at Big P, but you know what I mean? Like, I just think it's funny that he may literally be the, we don't know, but he may be the dregs of, you know, ancient historians, but he's the only one we've got. So we're like, he is amazing, you know?
Yeah, I mean, that's the case with so many cool sources like that, where it's like, we don't necessarily know the deal, but it's like, he's what we've got. So we've got to love him. Like, Pausanias is so interesting and I just love him. But I do think what you're saying about like him maybe being, I don't even know. Like, I'm trying to remember what this guest told me.
The dregs of historian society.
Yeah. But there was like something where he was kind of seen like that, I think, for like a really long time. What? I'm trying to remember what this guest told me. But okay. Yeah.
I don't know this. I would love to know this because this would just be hilarious to me.
Like, yeah, the episode will come out fairly soon, I think, or in a little while. I don't know. But like.
Great. I will listen.
Yeah. Dan Stewart is the one who told me this. And it's like this, the Roman period episode that'll be coming out. But it's just, yeah, it was really fascinating hearing kind of about what Pausanias was sort of viewed as, or how he was understood in the ancient world, which is that I think he got like very little respect or appreciation in the ancient world.
Pausanias.
I know. Man. And like, meanwhile, yeah, we come in and it's like, no, it's actually incredibly helpful to have somebody who went around and like described the things he saw, because they're gone now. Yeah. It's so amazing. Yeah.
I know. I do wonder, like, without getting us too off topic, I don't want to go away from Greeks, but like, I do wonder about if our entire society was eviscerated by a nuke tomorrow and we all died. We kind of got Greekified, where you find stragglers in the ground and you're like, oh my God, this was. I do wonder what would survive enough to give people an idea of the world. Like, you know, I don't know if Big Ben got destroyed and people are like, there was once a big tower and they're like, what? You know what I mean? I wonder who would be, where they would get that evidence from nowadays, you know?
And we have such weird things, and there's so much like time period in between that, yeah, like you just kind of find any and everything, or like find a museum and then be extra confused, or I don't know. Yeah, it's interesting to think about.
It is. Crete.
Yes. Crete. No, I was just going to do the same thing. Along. Yep. So yeah, okay, Crete. Yeah. Tell me about Crete.
Tell you about Crete. Okay, I will start you with Crete, and then I will wait for questions help focus me, so I will start you with another view. Crete in the Hellenistic period. Oh God, this is interesting. I sounded really unenthusiastic when I said that. It is interesting. It's not, Crete in the Hellenistic, so interesting. No, it is good. Okay, so basically a lot of scholars and other people really interested with Crete in the Minoan period, which I don't give two flying rats. There was,
It's pretty cool back then, but fine.
It is cool, but like, you know, it's also like, oh, well, I don't know. Everyone does it. I don't know.
No, that's fair.
Crete during the Hellenistic period, it's interesting because we don't have a lot of information about it. I mean, we do, but we kind of, like with all these things, we do, but we don't. But the interesting thing is Crete's built in an aristocratic society, much more than other places in Greece are. They're kind of like the, I was going to use a bad stereotype. I'm not going to use that. They're sort of like the black sheep of the Greek world. You know, in that they're different. There's a scholar called Polybius, a historian rather called Polybius, who says they're all rapists and murderers. which by the way isn't true, as you probably could have guessed. It's not an entire island full of rapists and murderers. But Polybius didn't really like them, but I think it's because they killed his dad or something at some point, so he had a bit of a chip on his shoulder, if I remember correctly. Polybius, oh my God, Polybius was he was from Megalopolis.
Yes, he was.
Yeah, good old Megalopolis coming back
around. I always think of the Athenians for stuff like that, you know, especially.
I don't blame you. They usually are, frankly, but he wasn't. He was from Megalopolis.
Interesting, yeah. Like, especially when it comes to Crete, I always think about that because I'm kind of obsessed with the idea of, like, the whole Theseus and Minotaur just being Athenian propaganda, which it, like, basically was, but I really, like, just want to understand it better as Athenian propaganda, because it's like, I'm sure the Minoans weren't going around being like, so, you know, every year we sacrificed all of these people to this monster we kept downstairs, like.
Well, I mean, you say that, but first of all, I'm sorry, I have to take issue with the fact you called it a minotaur and not a minotaur. I know that's an
because I am.
Across. I know.
British.
I'm sorry.
However, okay, no, you brought it up, so now I have to make this argument. I've had this argument with my friend who is also not British, but she lived there long enough that she says minotaur, and it drives me bonkers because the ancient Greek did not really have a hard I sound. So if one of them is going to be more accurate, it's minotaur.
Linguistics time. Okay, fine. I will concede Minotaur. Defeat because I don't think anyone wants to listen to us argue for 50 minutes over freaking Minotaur. But I had to say it because it's one of my I was noticing people say it. But
it's very British to say Minotaur.
Moving on from that. You said again the Cretans would not be kind of being like, woohoo, we slaughtered loads of people, woohoo, we come to Crete, lovely. The thing is though, on all their coinage, well, deeply into the Hellenistic period too as well, they have images of the labyrinth and on their Colossus mm-hmm. does anyway. So they clearly were being like, yes, we're the labyrinth, we're the Minotaur. So
yeah, but I don't, like, I think that they...
It's a bit it's dodgy, like, they kind of...
It is. It's really questionable. But I also think it's more so that it was like, that was really indicative of their whole culture versus the Theseus part of, you know, they were sacrificing. Like, I don't think they were necessarily talking about how evil the Minotaur was. They were just like, we have this labyrinth and we're cool and we've got bulls everywhere. Mm-hmm. And, you know, sometimes a half bull man, it's fine.
Sometimes a half bull man. Yeah, that's
yeah,
sometimes.
You know, totally
just
normal.
Casually just roaming yeah. about. Well, actually, so I've got stuff I can say about Athens as well and about their propaganda. With the idea of, like, you know, oh god, there's so much to say. Very quickly, you're probably right about that, to be fair. They focus really just on the labyrinth, as far as I can tell, and you're right, they're not really focused much on the grisly sacrifices of death, because it's not really you know, the Greeks, where they came to their myth, didn't really always practice the morals we did, you know, because, you know, yeah. Zeus going around impregnating everything, much of that being rape, was not something we would stand by, but the Greeks were like, woohoo, go Zeus.
This is great, it's fine.
This is great. So obviously things are a little bit different, but no, you're probably right about that. But I should focus on Crete, but I will say one quick thing about Theseus. I read a really interesting article by a person called Turner. I cannot remember her first name, which is terrible, but she wrote basically about how Theseus is both the son of Aegeus, the king of Attica, and Poseidon, god of the sea. Mm-hmm. But the story is like, they basically, the Athenians blur it, so you never really know who his actual dad is, because that way they could be like, no, we've come to Attica because we're descended from Theseus and Aegeus, but no, we could also control the sea because Poseidon. And they just let this exist on like a blurry thing, and every time you've probably got someone being like, so which one is it? They're like,
both, kind of, it's fine, they had sex with a woman on the same night, so it's both.
That's it. Yeah, you just you know when you're pregnant a woman, if you do it quickly, both of them combine into one, everyone knows that.
Genetics god
To be fair, actually, I mean, we all talk about a god in one of these places, so maybe his genetics can literally, sperm can match onto Aegeus's and make a super kid.
We don't know. Yeah.
I mean, the guy controls the ocean. I mean, you know, could have happened. You know what? Wow, I think I've just cracked the case of how these can coexist.
So yeah, I mean,
sperm god. That's the next paper coming out.
I mean, that sounds like so Poseidon.
Poseidon. Yeah. Okay, Crete. I would talk about Crete. Okay, so basically Crete is a bit of a hot mess during the Hellenistic, and all the cities are expanding. You've heard that story before, Megalopolis? Well, it's the same on Crete. There's one city called Hierapytna, which is, let me see, how do I describe this without having a visual reference? It's, so you've got Crete, you've got the middle of Crete. It's like sort of off the middle of Crete towards the east, but like southeast, very southeast, but not, you know, when the island kind of like thins out and then gets like a bulbous end so much? Mm-hmm. It's not there. It's kind of the bit before that. It's the best way to describe it. This will help when people just look at Google.
I mean, I know the shape of the island of Crete so well that I knew exactly what you're talking about.
Oh my goodness.
Like, I think says too much about how much I stare at the map of Greece. But yeah, I get it.
I'm really happy I can actually describe that fully. So all these cities are expanding like crazy, but at the same time as this, it's really fascinating. So basically Crete is also, so I think Crete's a hot mess. It is for multiple reasons, because cities are expanding everywhere, but also mercenaries are, basically Crete's kind of like, it needs money, right? And because of its society, apparently an event happens. We don't know what it is, but it's called the event of the Hellenistic period. It could be an earthquake or some sort of famine of some kind. I'm not really sure. But something happened, and it meant that there wasn't basically loads of jobs. God, this sounds like 21st century Britain, but there wasn't lots of jobs on the island. and as such, Cretans had to move and emigrate. And one of the key things they got a lot of money for and a lot of good reputation for were mercenaries to help the new Hellenistic collection of kings fight wars and take land. So Crete exports lots of its men as mercenaries off the island. They get lots of money, and these people go flying across the Mediterranean, these Cretans. And that's like their thing. That's how they make money, by selling soldiers, not selling, they are hiring, renting soldiers, because they're mercenaries.
Yeah.
Um, But it's fascinating because these mercenaries go off and then they come back. They encounter new mythological stories. And then they come back with these mythological stories and they tell them to Kree, like, hey, did you know? So the best one is in Itanos, on the very east of Crete, like sort of near the north bit of it. They come back with Egyptian stories. They're like, hey, did you know Isis? Woohoo! And all the other Cretans are like, what the hell are you talking about? But yeah, that's, and so these mercenaries bring these new myths to Crete. And then these new towns get like hybridized, like Egyptian, Cretan, Greeky myths, myths, which is just really cool.
Yeah,
it's really cool. Traveling myths.
I have to bring this up because I just have to. Have you played the game Assassin's Creed Odyssey?
Yes, I have played that game. Yes, I didn't finish it though because I got burnt out. I couldn't explore the Greek islands. Like, stop
so
it.
You have
I'm doing a cool. Don't cut this from the podcast. Ubisoft, go back to making games like Assassin's Creed 2, Assassin's Creed 1. Please don't give me another Odyssey. I say that as a lover of Greece.
Odyssey is so good. Oh my god. So did you not get to Crete? Because everything you just described sounds
Crete.
Like. But okay, that's exactly how Crete is in the game. Like, it's all about mercenaries, and I just
it
love
is,
that.
Yeah.
Anyway, it's that's fair, all I can not, think about.
No, I mean, you're not. I mean, not wrong. To be fair, before we go off, full credit to Ubisoft. To be fair, they did do their research. To be honest, like, a lot of the stuff is pretty, like, you know, pretty accurate. Actually, to be fair,
I've
especially
played
for
that
a video game,
so many times. Yeah,
it's really good virtual tourism. I will give it that. Like, I'm not going to be into it. It's amazing virtual tourism. I'm just a bit annoyed. I'm a very old school. I just like Assassin's Creed 1.
That's fair. It's the only video game I've ever played outside of N64. I am incredibly
you're missing out
biased.
On so much.
I know, I've heard so this. I'll try more eventually, but until then I just keep playing Assassin's Creed Odyssey. It's really bad. Anyway, yeah. Mercenaries, I love that. That's really interesting. Like, so did they really like jump in on Egyptian specifically and have a lot of this kind of like hybridization that remained?
So this is the really interesting thing about it. Basically, you have these Cretans come along in certain areas like Atanos, these Egyptian and Greek myths kind of converge and do loads of weird hybrid-y stuff. But this doesn't seem to be the case for the rest of the island. So it seems to be quite contained. So it seems either you had Egyptian, eventually Roman or Greek, you know, traveling Greek mercenaries. And they kind of practiced their own religions on bits of Crete. You know, they didn't seem to have fully like penetrated the island and gone deeper into it. And I think there's multiple reasons for that. One of the most obvious ones being maybe you've got certain mercenaries living in these areas, like foreign mercenaries living in this area. So of course they practice their religions in those areas. But one of the theories I'm attached to is the reason these myths couldn't penetrate, right? These kind of new identities couldn't penetrate the island is because this goes into, so I'm going to have to pivot for a second, but only because I need to explain this to then explain that.
Love tangents, don't worry.
Have you ever like come across lamps on, has anyone talked about like Greek lamps before?
Not Greek. I know about all the Roman penis lamps is really the only thing that comes to my mind if you talk about lamps, which is sad, but where my knowledge lies.
Okay. Not penis lamps, though. My God, that sounds interesting. I must have missed that episode.
They've
that
got wings.
Really good.
I don't, it's not even an episode.
Penis
I just
wings? Oh my
yeah,
God.
They're all over Pompeii.
Oh, I know. Oh, no, I know the penises of Pompeii. I just didn't realize they had wings. Wow, Pompeii, innovator. So lamps, but no, they're not penis lamps, sadly. They're kind of like normal looking lamps. But they've got loads of different holes. Some of them have got loads of different holes all over them, right? Which means that if you should put a light into them, the light goes in loads of funky different ways. You know, it's a bit weird. Long story short, this could basically be different ways of practicing ritual. So they had different people had different ways of describing, imagining, or understanding these lights and what they meant. Like, there's loads of different lights because that goes to Demeter, goddess of the light, and there was a version of her on Crete. By the way, loads of different versions. So, you know, obviously these rituals were attended to these gods and goddesses. But the main thing I want to build off of that is if you and I, for example, say we're both Egyptians, right? And we come along to Crete and we're like, yeah, we're going to spread some Egyptian religion. Woo! We go to the first town away from Atanas when we walk out and we go to this sanctuary. I'm like, great. We walk in and you see these people with this lamp, like humming and stuff and having this like this weird, these lights going everywhere. You would probably look at that and be like, what the fuck is going on? Like, what is that lamp? What are they doing with it? What does it mean? you'd have no idea, would you? Unless someone took the time to come up to you and be like, okay, so this is the lamp. We do it to worship Demeter in a special light form. Oh, you haven't heard of a light form? Well, that's local to this area. And all these little lights are symbolizing all the different paths she takes throughout her life. And you're like, what? You wouldn't know that unless you're told it. Yeah. And I think that may be one of the reasons these foreign identities and myths do not penetrate the island, because you come up with your myth and they kind of rebuff you. They're like, you don't understand it. You can't engage with the topic. You can't adapt your, like, you know, your like Egyptian myth to the local Cretan myths, because you don't know the myth. You don't understand it. So you can't be like, oh, okay, I get that that's about, you know, Demeter and the light. Oh, we have a god like that and they do this. And maybe they're the same thing. They both visited that, you know, you adapt the myth and that way you build like a collective identity.
Yeah.
I think they could do that because they had no idea what was going on. And the Cretans kind of pushed them away deliberately because of it. You know, they made sure to gatekeep basically, which the Cretans would, I definitely think they would have done, because they weren't an insular people. That's wrong, because there's loads of trade to be found, so I'm not trying to say that, but they were quite conservative in their customs. It makes sense they wouldn't be like, you know, hello, come on, welcome, you know, welcome everybody and their mum to Crete. So it's interesting. It's basically, you see this idea of myths. So I know we're not talking about like myths, mythical stories, I did say myth works, but yeah, these myths can't really penetrate this island because the people carrying the myths do not understand what's going on. So they can't attach the myths. Yeah. Or
so, okay. Now I want to know more though about this Demeter of like the light. Is there more you can say about her, or is she just totally baffling? Because that would make sense.
Sadly, it's really annoyed actually that I can't tell you much more about her because that's really disappointing. You have to cut this out like an idiot. I can't tell you much more about her because I've basically have not done my research on her yet.
No, that's fair.
Actually, you know, I've tried as well. I got really interested just like you. And the books were, I think they're buried in German or something. And I was like, oh goodness gracious me. So, it's a story for another day.
I phrased it like that, because it sounds like one where it'd be really difficult because I've never even heard of her. So it can't be something that you can easily learn more about.
Weird. Oh yeah, it's weird. It's very weird. But she is a certain, she is, I think she's called like Demeter Lightbringer. She sounds like a kind of like, don't know, some sort of like metal band player, Lightbringer.
Yeah.
Sounds like a biblical figure. I love it. I don't know much more about it. Sadly.
No, that's fair. Sounds cool.
It does sound cool, doesn't it?
Yeah.
It sounds really cool. Okay. I've got other stuff I can tell you about Crete as well.
Yeah,
I'm just thinking, please. Because I went off on foreign mercenaries randomly for the wrong reason. But so you've got the foreign mercenaries. And I said Hierapytna and other cities were expanding at this point. Well, you've also got, so you've got Hierapytna. So let's take Hierapytna as a good example. They're expanding, and as such, they're taking over other communities. So, you know, like, get away. And one of the things they do is they control the myth and religion of these towns. So there's evidence of them having destroyed cults around towns. And at this place called Eleros, they actually like put up their rules on the sanctuary temple, which, you know, is a big, that's like a big, not a no-no, but that's a big, ooh, they're making a message here. Because if, you know, on the big sanctuary, which is communal and everyone goes to and is kind of authorized by the god of the area, they've put their rules on it. It's kind of showing the gods are authorizing their rules. Like, you know, they're really cementing their opinions and their, like, you know, things onto poor Alaris. So basically we don't know, is maybe too strong. It's suggested that these smaller communities are losing their autonomy. You know, they're losing their identities, their myths, their autonomies, they're all being stripped away from them. That sucks. So you know what they do instead to retain autonomy is they fall back on this thing called pastoral mythologies. They're really cool. I get really excited. So pastoral mythologies are like Pan, nymphs, and wood dryads, all that type of stuff, you know, like landscape type gods and goddesses.
The thing you think of for Arcadia, not necessarily Crete.
Exactly. But massively on Crete. It looks like they start to fall back on these, and we see so much. One thing, there's a goddess called Dictenia, I believe I'm saying it correctly. She's a goddess of nets. Have you heard of her before?
No, but the idea of a goddess of nets makes me so happy. No,
she's
okay.
Cool.
Yeah, a goddess of nets, like fishing nets mostly, or like
fishing nets, fish, because Crete's an island, so fishing. Yeah. So they need to Dictenia, the fishing net goddess. Anyway, but during the Hellenistic period, she starts as goddess of nets, and then she transforms throughout the Hellenistic period into like a goddess of the hunt, like Artemis. She takes Artemis image, like a bow and an arrow and hunting dogs, and The reason that may have happened is because the Cretans are transforming her into something they need, which is a pastoral goddess, mm-hmm. someone who's connected to the landscape. So that's really fascinating. So you yeah. see myth changing in real time, really rapidly too, like yeah. over like 100 years or so. That's rapid.
Well, and Crete has got to be one of the few islands that can kind of get away with such pastoral myths too, because it's so much bigger than all the other ones. Like, it is, I feel yeah. like the rest don't have that kind of landscape that would sort of lend itself. Yeah. Like, obviously they're big enough, but Crete is so enormous.
It is, yeah, absolutely. And yeah. it's so bloody rocky and mountainous. When I, yeah. when I went to Crete, I tried to drive up a hill and the car broke down and I had to splutter the car up. I think it took me 40 minutes to go up this hill on the spluttering car. God.
Are you still searching for your perfect place to call home? Well, now is the time to buy at Fisher Homes. If you're looking to move in before the end of 2024, May could be your last opportunity to start building your dream home and close before the year's end. If you're hoping to move in even sooner, Fisher Homes also has homes that are move-in ready and waiting for you, where you can start enjoying the benefits of homeownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with a new home advisor today at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home.
Had enough of those supplements that leave you feeling nothing? Symbionica is your solution to great-tasting, all-natural supplements that actually work. Crafted with premium plant-based ingredients, their products have no seed oils, fillers, or toxins. Try them out and actually feel the difference today. Visit Symbionica.com and use code IHEART for 15% off plus free shipping on your subscription order. Again, that's 15% off plus free shipping on your subscription order. Go to Symbionica.com. C-Y-M-B-I-O. T-I-K-A.com.
Now I'd like to introduce you to Meaningful Beauty, the famed skincare brand created by iconic supermodel Cindy Crawford. It's her secret to absolutely gorgeous skin. Meaningful Beauty makes powerful and effective skincare simple, and it's loved by millions of women. It's formulated for all ages and all skin tones and types, and it's designed to work as a complete skincare system, leaving your skin feeling soft, smooth, and nourished. I recommend starting with Cindy's full regimen, which contains all five of her best-selling products, including the amazing Youth Activating Melon Serum. This next generation serum has the power of melon leaf stem cell technology. It's melon leaf stem cells encapsulated for freshness and released onto the skin to support a visible reduction in the appearance of wrinkles. With thousands of glowing five-star reviews, why not give it a try? Subscribe today and you can get the amazing Meaningful Beauty System for just $49.95. That includes our introductory five-piece system, free gifts, free shipping, and a 60-day money-back guarantee. All of that available at MeaningfulBeauty.com. With every CBD product claiming to do something different, it's nearly impossible to decide what's best for you. Lazarus Naturals pioneered the farm-to-front-door model of transparency where they handle each step of the production process to ensure quality, potency, and consistency. Scannable labels allow you to see the test results of your hemp batch so you can be confident in the safety and quality. Visit LazarusNaturals.com today. Lazarus Naturals, committed to improving your life as well as the world around you. Not available in Idaho, Iowa, or South Dakota.
Yeah, Crete is wild. The Cretan landscape, like, I will never get over it. I don't think I, like, love anything more. I went there a couple years ago with some friends, and we rented a convertible and drove down to Pelopolis, which is that what it's called? Yeah, there's so many that are, like, mm-hmm. anyway, but it's one, like, really old, and it's, like, you have to drive all the way through the mountains, and then there's this beach that you have to drive through, like, literally not a road, just like this rocky kind of landscape directly next to the water. Yeah. We were like, how are we in this car? This is not a good idea. We're going to destroy this thing. Like,
this is awful. It was, no, absolutely.
Oh my God. But yeah, Cretan landscape is wild. Like, it's just unlike anything else. I'm obsessed with it. So thank you for bringing it up.
So basically you've got these goddesses turned into pastoral gods, right? And goddesses, right? Mm-hmm. So they're transforming in kind of shape. We have some lovely material culture. One of them is a clay mold relief of Pan's face, like you put on pot. So clearly they're making lots of these because they've got a mold for it that they just can stamp and fill.
Yeah.
So apparently people are loving the Pastora myths. They're loving the pan, you know. This is real good at this point. So the question, of course, you may be thinking, or you may not, but I'm thinking, is why? Like, why do they start loving pastoral myths so much? Because there's definitely an increase in it.
Yeah.
And Tigers as well, in the Greek anthology, all the creature names, well, not all of them, some of the creature names seem to have bucolic origins. They got like little bucolic kind of entomologies, origins.
Yeah.
It's really weird. The Cretans love the landscape. They love pastoralism in this period.
Yeah. I mean, I can see it. I'm like, I can just picture Cretan's landscape and I'm just, yeah.
Picture the sun and the rolling hills and the hidden police officers. Picture all of it. It's fantastic, you know. It's really good. So you have to ask yourself why do they care so much about pastoralism now? And there's mm-hmm. multiple reasons. Three of them that I've identified. One, the event. I guess it's the event. This ominous thing I do not know about, and no one seems to know. Not even I would say his name wrong. Haniotis, he's a Greek scholar, and he don't think he knows, and he's like the super foremost expert as far as I can tell on all this stuff. So, you know, even he's like, I don't really know, actually, and he's speculating.
Yeah.
So we don't know what it is, unless someone's going to send me an article tomorrow and I'll find out that I'm wrong. But anyway, the event. So it could be an earthquake or a famine, but mainly it's probably spurred them to practice stuff like transhumance, so the movement of cattle and stuff like that. More frequently, because they needed to for food and survival resources, that type of thing. So mm-hmm. that may have been why. Because, you know, if animal husbandry and such becomes so important to the society, more important than it ever was before, you know, mythology is going to reflect that, because they're going to be worshipping pastoral gods to make sure the cattle survive. You know, please, Pan, mm-hmm. don't kill them, you know, type of thing. So, you know, it makes sense why they may be moving towards this, and why Titania may be becoming like a huntress who looks after their cattle or helps them to hunt. And, you know, you can sort of see why these myths transform to match what the societies need at the time, because
mm-hmm.
that makes sense. The other one, the one I like most, I've always got my own pet theory, the one I like, and it always comes back to being a plucky underdog, which is gonna maybe a problem. Actually, I need to maybe move away from that, because everything ends up being Rocky the movie, basically, but Greek. So you had Hirapitna taking over these communities, right? I like to think that their gods are stripped off them, like, you're done, you get rid of them. So they're like, crap, how are we going to have an identity? How are we going to have myths that we can believe in and attach ourselves to and, you know, bond with and collate around and blah, blah, blah.
Mm-hmm.
I'm thinking they were like, okay, you know what? They can't take the mountain. They can't take the mountains. They can change who's in the caves, but they can't take the rivers and the landscapes. So I think they've already manufactured, but they start to put more emphasis on these pastoral myths, because that's something these cities can't take away from them. They're so general, they're so mixed, everyone believes in them, that mm-hmm. if you attach yourself to them, that's not going to be ripped from you or taken from you, likely. And therefore you can create that, and you can kind of create an identity around that myth.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that can become your new sense of definition, your new sense of self. And I think that's why they start to, one of the reasons, it's probably all of them simultaneously, but that may be one of the reasons these myths become more popular, because they're now their new way of expressing their own sense of identity and their own autonomy, irregardless of the massive evil city which has taken them over and, you know, kind of forced their Hirapitnian, for example, you know, views upon them.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. So, yes.
That's lovely. Really interesting. Yeah. I love the net goddess becoming a hunt goddess. That's so interesting and weird. And I'll never get over that there's a net goddess. So thank you. I'm literally going to text my
this
friend
really,
immediately.
This really got you, didn't it? To be fair, this really got you. I was going over, it's like, oh, they did this for identity. You're like, but net goddess?
No, I mean, like, the identity, fascinating generally, but still can't get over the net goddess. I love learning about such specific and bizarre. Yeah, I mean, they just had gods and goddesses for everything, and I never think about nets. That's just new one. I don't know why it's really holding on to me. Yeah, I absolutely love that. And I also am really fascinated by Tyr. So I want to make sure that we talk about Tyr. Yeah. Is there more about Crete, though? Like, I don't want to cut you off on Crete.
That's all I got. My holsters. You know, I could go on for ages, but we're not going to.
Yeah.
I've said my piece. You know about how they use myth now to try and survive. Maybe.
Yeah. Well, and it is interesting that, like, the pastoral stuff does seem like the one, they can't take away, because it's like, it's also like, not only is it clearly tied to the landscape and everything so necessarily, mm-hmm. but it is also like broader, right? Like you're saying, like, I mean, and even just the way you can connect it to Arcadia, it's like, it's a very sort of broadly Greek concept mm-hmm. and these stories. So they feel a bit more, harder to wrench away.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I think that's one of them anyway. Or it could have been the larger cities using it to help connect them with the smaller communities. But who knows? We don't know. So anyway, there you go.
Speculation. It's fun.
Speculation. Interpretation. Yes. Tyre.
Tyre.
See, you're probably right. It's probably tier, and I call it tyre, and I don't know what it is. I've said tyre for so long now, and no one's corrected me. I have to assume that someone would have taken pity on me by now.
It honestly, like, any of these pronunciations, though, like, they're always going to be based in accent and English and all these different things. Like, you know, it is what
tyre.
It is.
I'm gonna switch between and confuse everybody. So, great. You know, I'm going
to
be like,
I'm going to have trouble not saying tyre, but. So we'll just we're talking about the city in Phoenicia, people. That's what matters.
Yes, we are. It's literally spelt tyre, like if you put a tyre on your car. It's spelt like
that. But that's only the British way of spelling tyre.
Fair enough.
So
the Phoenicians, they're interesting, they're fun. Lots of people, obviously not you or your listeners, I'm sure, but other people confuse them for Greeks many times. You know, they get a bit messed up. But they're not. Their name was Phoenic or Phoenix or Phoenix even, but the Greeks called them, which I thought was really cool. If they were actually called Phoenix, that's such a cool name to name some people.
Well, they have a prince named Phoenix. So the background on this is that I have a really deep and longstanding and like longer than anything else of my love of Greek mythology, obsession with Cadmus, lends itself to an obsession with Phoenicia. And like, I really don't know enough about actual historical Phoenicia or even like mythology beyond the very Greek Cadmus, but I am completely obsessed with Cadmus, and his brother is named Phoenix, which is Greek mythology but based in Phoenicia and where we get a lot of this stuff. And it's
That's so cool. I love Cadmus. He was a real G. He was very cool.
Absolutely.
I don't think he even did anything that dodgy, if I'm trying to remember my Cadmus history.
Yes, thank you. That's why I love him.
He didn't even do anything that dodgy.
Nope.
Which is a real
feat. He's pretty chill. Exactly.
For a Greek Phoenician hero. Yeah, very, very good.
I also, my little, and I will let you talk about Hellenistic tier, but like,
no, please, go ahead.
My obsession with Cadmus is that I think that there absolutely has to be a missing, like, epic or story that explained more about him, because he is incredibly unique. He's a hero who did not really assault anybody. He
maybe that's why he did get epic, because the Greeks didn't really, they were like, oh, there's no rape, he didn't rape anyone, oh, screw him, he's
God,
boring.
Yeah, he's boring. No, but he's like, he's that, he's Phoenician, but also like, they make him Greek. They have him bring the Phoenician alphabet to Greece to explain how the Greek alphabet came to be. They have him marry a literal goddess, and then she is also supremely unique.
Marry it up. Married like, above your station,
truly,
right?
Truly, he's the only hero who marries a goddess, and not only is she's not just like any old goddess, she's literally just the daughter of Aphrodite and Ares, like two Olympians. Yeah. And she doesn't do any goddess things. She just lives with Cadmus forever. And then they have like this incredibly famous dynasty of children. And yeah, I just think there has to be more there, because we have so little sourcing on them. But like, they're objectively so cool.
I would agree. I would agree. And to be fair, you look at the Phoenician coinage, they're really pushing forward the story of Europa and all the stuff that leads to quite significantly. So I would agree with you. I would actually, you know what? I would almost be willing to very certainly say there must have been something pretty big, but it's just been lost. Because, it's way too cool. But imagine how pretty those children were of Cadmus and Aphrodite, like Aphrodite descended kids or daughter. You know what I mean? Like that. They must have been some good looking kids.
When like she, kids. They're all just so unique. Well, and then also their kids are like, you know, people like Semele, who then goes on to become the mother of Dionysus. Like, they're just all wild. Oh, yeah. That whole family. I could talk about them forever. God, yeah. I will try not to.
No, that's fine. No, absolutely. They're really goddamn cool.
Cool.
They're really cool. No, really cool. Yeah. Okay, I would talk about Tyre. I would try to I feel like I've been a bit too historian, so I'll try to keep it a bit more mythy.
It's all interesting, don't worry.
Okay, good. Okay, so let me think. Okay, so long story short, Alexander dies, you have the Diadochi Wars, and you have Ptolemy and Seleucid. Anyway, long story short, basically it seems that they take turns basically making Tyre or Tyre their punching bag. The poor city, like, I read from this one scholar Granger says it's almost like they had an out for Tyre, because like, it gets so beaten up in the Diadochi Wars, and it keeps trying to be like, no, we'll defend and rebel against you, and they're like, nah, come back here, loser, and they just like punch it again. It's like, I'm just like, please leave it alone. It's like that, that Simpsons meme with the stop it, it's already dead. It's like that for Tia Tyre. Like, please stop it. The city's already been razed multiple times. Oh. So I feel bad. I know.
You think about that, and then the fact that they, like, Carthage was a Phoenician, like, from, like, a colony from originally Tyre. And then what happened to them? Like, yeah, my God, these poor Phoenician people.
I know, it's not going well for them.
No.
And honestly, looking at modern day too, it's still not going well for them.
Yeah. Colonialism, though.
That city in a past life must have done something to piss someone off, because poor thing. So anyway, Tyre Tyre. So it gets beaten up. And there are some that say, like, its cultural heritage gets eviscerated. I think that's a bit too strong. I don't think it gets eviscerated. But it probably got all their records are destroyed and multiple attacks in the city, stuff like that. I can believe that, you know, their identity and that their sense of self was a little bit, and their myths were a little bit, like, frazzled after that. I can certainly believe that after being beaten up so many times. But then basically you get this really interesting mix between Melkart and Heracles, and that's what I'm going to talk about, the myth bit. So first thing, loads of people think that, I should probably explain who these people, I mean, everyone knows Heracles, so I'm going to assume that bloody loser is everywhere, everyone knows him, but Melkart, Melkart's basically, he seems to be a relatively local god to Tyre, and I think Sidon as well. Actually, I think he's around the Phoenician area, but we'll focus on him there. So his name's called Bao, like king of the city, and he's also involved in, like, some sort of ritual burning, where it's like a sort of reawakening thing, which ties him to Heracles, because Heracles was also burnt when he died.
Right! I didn't even think about that.
You start to see the links already. So the two, Melkart and Heracles, are really quite well linked. It does seem, there's one person who says that Melkart, started off as Melkart in Phoenicia, moved to Greece way back in the day, like 10th century, 11th century, way back in the day, and the Greeks kind of liked him, turned into Heracles, and then he migrated back to Phoenicia. Like, Heracles being like, you know, they kind of been, basically, Heracles did create Melkart, maybe Melkart who created Heracles. But of all these things, we don't really know.
The Greeks wouldn't have a reason, though, to, like, make it the opposite. Yeah, but, like, again, I mean,
pretty sketchy anyway, we're not really too sure.
Yeah, but also, like, I mean, a lot of the, especially, like, in Phoenician, that whole area, obviously all of the East, like, really influenced so many different Greek deities and stuff too, right? Which is just sort
of
the way they just kind of went back and forth and then changed the stories to make it seem like maybe actually the Greeks influenced them. You're like, nah, it's probably they influenced you.
No, it's like, definitely, because I think Aphrodite's an Indo-European goddess, isn't she, at least at the stage comes to Greece, so, you know.
Yeah, she's really connected to the Phoenician goddess Astarte. Yeah. And so you've got, all these different kind of back and forth gods and heroes. And I mean, Heracles is so unique too, because, like, almost everyone can claim kind of like their own version of Heracles.
So it's really fascinating. But basically you've got Tyre a bit of a straight, and you have to realize as well, before they got beaten up in the Hellenistic period, people already had cottoned onto this link between Melkart and Heracles, the fact they were quite similar, they kind of held similar things. The Greeks used to call, so Herodotus, for example, calls Melkart the Tyrian, or Tyrian, whatever, Heracles. They're already kind of thinking of it as, like, another form of Heracles, which they've represented in a Greek way. I don't know if maybe the Tyrians presented Heracles as, you know, Melkart as Heracles to the Greeks, maybe to help them understand, or they just went, oh, that looks similar, you know, yeah, he's Heracles, because, you know, the Greeks being Greeks, you wander along with a little book, and you're like, yeah, it looks like him, and they just make it up. I don't know, but this links already exists between the two of them. But as we move into the Hellenistic period, you kind of get, I mean, it kind of gets enhanced, because the Greeks start not taking over, but, like, the links between Phoenicia and Greece start to become a bit more, like, marked, you know, they get a bit of hybridity, their cultures kind of cross culturally entangling, you know, they're really, they're merging into not one either, so I'm saying all the wrong things, they get more connected in the Hellenistic period, so this link between Heracles and Melkart does become even more important than it already was. And it apparently it's from this process, because I'm about to refute this, I don't like this, but I need to say it. It's called Hellenization, which I don't like.
Oh, yeah.
It's very colonial, and it implies basically the Greeks came along and Hellenized the Levantines, the Phoenicians. That obviously isn't true, but I have to admit, it's an interesting way to start the conversation, because it does frame what's happening to a degree in the fact that, you know, they were meeting each other. It's far more of a give and take situation. The Phoenicians got something, the Greeks got something, you know. Yeah, exactly. A nice hybrid melding, you know. But it looks like basically, so they come along, right? And Heracles and Melkart, they kind of get mixed into one. That's the interesting bit. So you start to see hybrid images of Melkart where he's wearing like the lion skin. Hmm. It's really interesting. There's one image of him where it looks like he's got like a lion cap, because like a sort of Phoenician or Tyrian cap, not like a skin. Right. So You see all these really interesting morphed versions of the myths as they try to kind of reconcile the two different gods together and make them into like one. And that's and it's really interesting. So you get this lovely bit of mythical hybridity happening entirely as the two of them connect up, basically, which is just fascinating. It's really good.
I love that. Yeah, that's the one thing I really remember about, like, so I had on Eduardo Garcia Molina, who studies the Hellenistic period, and we talked about all of that, and like that was where we kind of, it was mostly in the East, and so it's interesting to hear you talking about it this way, because that's the thing that really like came across so strongly to me, is that they didn't go in and, like, they did colonize it, obviously, to an extent, but, like, they didn't go in and just, like, force. They didn't do it like North America did, you know, which is, like, completely force, you know, the, like, British way of life onto an indigenous people and completely decimate their indigeneity. Like, absolutely, instead, they went in and they were like, you've got these temples to your gods. We're going to, like, toss in some Greek stuff and kind of squish it all together and sort of make something new.
Yeah, exactly.
But also, yeah, not take away what is already part of the culture, which is really interesting and sort of just like, I guess, just generally refreshing given the rest of like most colonization, certainly modern colonization, is like,
it's
kind of nice. You're like, oh, you didn't completely take away everything they had before. Cool of you.
Yeah, no, I know. I agree. I was really, when I read this, I was really quite refreshed. I was like, oh, that's a difference, isn't it? Not coming
our
in and saying
that. Our bar is so low.
I know, our bar is so low. As long as they don't come in and say your culture's shit and then try to change everything, you're like, oh my God, they're true patrons, champions of equality. They don't. I think it's because you get Greek settlers who like trickle into Tyre. Mm-hmm. I'm going to keep just double barreling it the entire time. Tyre. They come in like, you get all of them, you get like a steady stream of Greek settlers. You know what I mean? That's why you got this Macedonian garrison, but you got the Tyrian kings, and it's all a bit of a mess. It's kind of because the city was already a bit of a hodgepodge already, really, by the Hellenistic period, that I think that's why this kind of, this hybrid mythology start to come about like more gently and less, you know, extremely, the colonization with the capital C. I think that's why, really, because it was just more of a gentle, slow process. Helps the gods are so mixed, so related to one another.
They are, especially across the whole Mediterranean, except the Egyptians who, you know, put animals on everything. But like, it's so easy
to be fair,
see.
I think I would as well, actually, if I was making
I mean,
myths,
yeah, I love the Egyptian gods, don't get me wrong. Yeah. But like, it is, it's so easy to kind of see your own god in the local gods in the East.
Absolutely.
But also, like you're saying, like there was so much like immigration too. Like really, the whole ancient Mediterranean was pretty mixed up. And kind of just like everyone all over the place. So then, by the time the people come in and they're like, well, we're actually ruling you now. But like, we've, you know, our people have kind of been here before. It's not brand new. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. No, absolutely. And it's just pretty fascinating. It's just pretty fascinating. Yeah. I love the hybridity about it.
Can you tell me, like, do you know anything about, you mentioned Europa being utilized by them a lot. Do you know much about that? Because I'm just curious. I didn't realize that they kind of took her on in that way. I realized I never kind of connected who necessarily invented her, if anyone kind of claimed inventing her.
Absolutely. You know what, actually, my general idea of Europa and going to that ties into going past the Hellenistic, where you go towards the Roman period. I think it's the second century AD, I think it is. I'm not a Romanist, so this is going to sound really frazzly, but I know this bit, so I'm just going to keep within my wheelhouse the bits I understand. So it's really fascinating because basically you've got Roman Empire, you've got Roman Empire. Great start already. You've got Roman Empire, and then you've got...
Rome doesn't matter, it's fine.
Yeah, no one cares about the Rome. Jolly come late. No one cares. But you have, you do have Tyre, and basically Tyre are like, they're showing the Roman emperor on the coin. We're a Roman colony, blah, 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 all that stuff. And then when Roman power starts to decline, they're a bit like, we can be us again. You see their coinage change. So they start putting their own local myths on the coins. Not really Melkart at this stage, though. There's a lovely coin of Melkart riding like a hippocampy. Just lovely.
Oh, cute.
He's just chilling out there with his little thing, riding his hippocampy. He looks
love
lovely.
That.
He looks fire. He looks so radiant. It's beautiful. But I mean, you never see Heracles in that kind of cool coinage. It's always Heracles just standing there at the club, like looking lazy. But this guy's running a freaking hippocampy. And he's on a bow, too. Right. Like, what's he going to shoot with a bow at sea? Like,
yeah.
What? I think if he shoots the water, the arrow will lose momentum. So I don't know what he's doing, but I mean, he's just living his life. He's going around his bow, firing into the water, hitting nothing. He doesn't care. Melkart don't care. He's happy. I think it's so cool. So Europa, basically, as they go away from the Roman colonies, they become a bit more, they get their own autonomy back, basically. And it's reflected on the coin. They start to, like, they start to talk about the alphabet that they gave the Greeks again. You know, like, we gave you this grammar. They show Europa the coins quite frequently because it's kind of, this is a local myth we have, which is regional and established power and connects us to Crete. You know, there's a lot of stuff to do with it. So you basically see over time, their mythological themes take over the coinage, their local ones, as their own identity starts to emerge, as they get to express themselves again.
Yeah.
And it's this beautiful progression of basically mythological identity over time, from being like subservient Roman emperors to Tyre in all its glory, because eventually it's just proper, beautiful, local, folly Tyrian coins coming out of it. That are just,
That's so cool.
All their images, Europa and the Greek text and their names, just them being them, really, eventually.
Yeah.
And it's lovely. It's really cool to see.
I have this whole book on the Phoenicians that I've been meaning to read forever, so I really don't know that much about them. But I'm curious about that, because it's like, I wish I knew more about Europa and whether she did kind of exist in the Phoenician mythology, like, before Greece, or even, like, simultaneously with when she was, you know, coming about in that, like, those most ancient kind of Greek myths. But it feels to me that it's almost like using her at that time period is also, like, there's still some of that Greek influence coming in. There's, like, you know, it's kind of like a melding of sort of, I mean, when you're talking about something that's like 2000 years, you know, everything's going to kind of meld together in really interesting ways. And like, specifically utilizing Europa feels like that in a really satisfying way. Also, she's on the Euro sometimes. And it's like, that's a nice little callback. Yeah. On certain Greek Euros. Because they're like, everyone gets their own. I know Greek has like a few different Euros, but Europa's definitely on one of them, like riding the bull.
That's cool. Oh, that's really cool. Oh man, I learned something new today. Yeah. I'm going to be searching there these coins. Collecting them. I didn't know I was going to start collecting euros, but it turns out I will.
That's like the only euro I have collected is the one with Europa, and also it's like the most appropriate euro of all of them. Like it's
absolutely.
Literally where the word comes from. I love it.
Yeah, it makes perfect sense.
Yeah.
Yeah, it makes perfect. Yeah, God. Yeah, you just reminded me. Yeah, man, she created like Europe. Oof.
Yeah. That's She's badass.
Fun. I mean, that's an achievement, isn't it? Like, imagine thinking, like, you come home, you're like, what did you do today? Oh, I filled in some documents. I created Europe.
Yeah.
Oh,
I just named a continent. Don't worry about it.
Yeah, don't worry about that. Can you imagine, like, an imposter syndrome? Like, oh, yeah, I named this island. I named a continent. Oh, no, it's not a big deal, though. You're like, oh, man, your self-esteem just like, plummets.
I mean, that just makes me think, like...
Do you reckon all the other Greek goddesses were annoyed with her? Like, that's why they hate her so much. They just felt so shit. They're just like,
bitch.
God damn. Yeah, exactly. Bitch. You
know, I just think about now, like, Cadmus and Europa have at least one, maybe two other siblings. I'm trying to think of how many, because I know Phoenix is one. And it's like, okay, Phoenix gets... He named Phoenicia. Cadmus gave the alphabet to Greece. Europa named Europe. But I have a feeling there's another one, and I just can't imagine being like fourth sibling.
No, there is a fourth sibling, and you are right. Yeah. I can't remember the name because to be fair, I announced at the start of the podcast, I don't remember anything in my brain. I have a terrible memory, sadly.
But, I'm looking it up in case it's extra funny and we miss it.
See, that's a good idea. I kind of hope he has done nothing now because it would just be
I know
funny.
Exactly because it's funnier if he's like, oh yeah, here we go, Kylix. Guy. C-I-L-I-X. Who's this guy? Sorry, dude. Like,
yeah, sorry, dude. Well, it's not. I mean, even if he is good, it can't be as good as founded a country. Or
no, exactly. Europa, Cadmus, Phoenix, and then that other guy. Oh, his name means like it's some kind of combination of
doesn't
like
mean
the
disappointment.
Words for horn
Does
and
his
crooked.
Name translates as disappointment?
His name just means disappointment. Exactly. Okay, what a beautiful way of wrapping up Phoenicia. Yeah. This has been clearly so much fun. I feel like I never quite know
so
what kind
fun.
Like, I'm very glad. I never quite know what the episode is going to turn out to. I'm like, this sounds really interesting. And like, it's always really interesting, but sometimes it turns into like, okay, also we're just going to laugh a hell of a lot about the ancient world. And I particularly love that. So thank you.
Good. No, good. Good. I came on my mantra before coming on was don't be bored. Don't be bored. Don't be boring.
It's never boring. I can talk about ancient Greece. Like, I can always pull out fascinating stuff because everybody knows something interesting. But it is extra helpful when it becomes a conversation that is both fascinating and ridiculous. Those are my favorites.
Absolutely. No, I'm with you. Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, this is the best. Do you have anywhere that you want my listeners to like follow you or learn more? Just kind of anything you want to share on that front?
Oh yeah, that's a good idea. Oh, you're gonna have to cut this. I'm gonna have to actually think about this.
That's fine.
I'm so bad at social stuff.
Yeah, I mean it's only if you want really to also, but
no, that's like, I mean, I probably should. That's what people keep telling. I probably should. So I will. Okay, let me think. Do I actually have anything? See, I'm so rubbish at social media that if they follow my social media profile, it's like one image. I'm gonna say it anyway because you never know, maybe it'll take off one day and they'll need to know.
There you go.
What is it? I think I'm at Jerome Ruddick on Twitter. It's really simple. I haven't got like a crazy cool name. I'm just at Jerome Ruddick, and otherwise I don't Facebook. I don't really have anything on like that. You don't follow people there, and I guess they could check out, if they want, they could check out my profile on the university. It's incredibly boring, but if they wanted to, it's got my email, so if they want to find me there they could. It's probably a good idea actually.
And you're at Newcastle, right?
Yeah, I'm at Newcastle, yeah. The main point is, for your soundbite, they can follow me on, I think I'm at Jerome Ruddick on Twitter, or better yet, if they want to email me to talk about anything, first of all, I am always so happy to talk about everything. I don't know if it came across this way on the podcast, but I'm such a friendly person and I love talking about things.
You sounded really mean during this whole, like, really.
I know, I was putting on my bitch mode, you know what I mean? Like, I was just trying to be as bitchy as possible. I love talking to people. I love helping out with things and answering questions. I really, really do. I know people don't believe that, but I do. So if you type in Jerome Ruddick at Newcastle University on Google, even my name would literally find the little profile that my university made for me. And that's where I've got an email, which is otherwise my email is something like j.m.l.ruddick2@newcastle.ac.uk. That's a mouthful.
Yeah, Google.
No one wants to say that. Google, yeah. Please, people, Google. So yes, that's where you can find me. And I am happy to be approached about literally anything. I love doing classics outreach, for example. So if you listened to any of this and thought, that's a fucking psycho that I won't mind doing some outreach with or anything, then come on board. That is it. That's my soundbite. There's
amazing.
You can replay that again. Yes.
Thank you so much for doing this. This has been so much fun.
Ozzy, thank you so much for having me. This has been really, really fun. Like, really, really fun. This has been good. I had a whale of a time. So
good. Nerds, thank you as always for listening again. Like, seriously, ridiculously fun episode, gods. Obviously, I love recording all of my conversations. I'm always learning so fucking much, and it's so interesting, and everyone is so nice, and it's seriously the coolest thing in the entire world that these people want to talk to me. But when I'm also laughing my ass off throughout, that's just a bonus. So huge thanks to Jerome for not only talking to me for this episode and sharing so much fascinating information, but also being hilarious and also for waiting forever for the episode to come out. Thank you, Jerome. Let's Talk About Myths, Baby is written and produced by me, Liv Albert. Michaela Smith is the Hermes to my Olympians, and I know so many podcast-related things, from running the YouTube to creating promotional images and video to editing and research. The podcast is hosted and monetized by iHeartMedia. Help me continue bringing you the world of Greek mythology and the ancient Mediterranean by becoming a patron, where you'll get bonus episodes and more. Visit patreon.com/mythsbaby or click the link in this episode's description. I am Liv, and gods, I love this shit. Thank you for coming along with me all the time. It's just super cool.
Are you still searching for your perfect place to call home? Well, now is the time to buy at Fisher Homes. If you're looking to move in before the end of 2024, May could be your last opportunity to start building your dream home and close before the year's end. If you're hoping to move in even sooner, Fisher Homes also has homes that are move-in ready and waiting for you, where you can start enjoying the benefits of homeownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with a new home advisor today at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home.
Had enough of those supplements that leave you feeling nothing? Symbiotica is your solution to great-tasting, all-natural supplements that actually work. Crafted with premium plant-based ingredients, their products have no seed oils, fillers, or artificial nonsense. It's just pure goodness in every pouch. Try them out and actually feel the difference today. Visit Symbiotica.com and use code IHEART for 15% off plus free shipping on your subscription order. Again, that's 15% off plus free shipping on your subscription order. Go to Symbiotica.com. That's Symbiotica.com.
Now I'd like to introduce you to Meaningful Beauty, the famed skincare brand created by iconic supermodel Cindy Crawford. It's her secret to absolutely gorgeous skin. Meaningful Beauty makes powerful and effective skincare simple, and it's loved by millions of women. It's formulated for all ages and all skin tones and types, and it's designed to work as a complete skincare system, leaving your skin feeling soft, smooth, and nourished. I recommend starting with Cindy's full regimen, which contains all five of her best-selling products, including the amazing Youth-Activating Melon Serum. This next-generation serum has the power of melon leaf stem cell technology. It's melon leaf stem cells encapsulated for freshness and released onto the skin to support a visible reduction in the appearance of wrinkles. With thousands of glowing five-star reviews, why not give it a try? Subscribe today and you can get the amazing Meaningful Beauty System for just $49.95. That includes our introductory five-piece system, free gifts, free shipping, and a 60-day money-back guarantee. All that available at MeaningfulBeauty.com. With every CBD product claiming to do something different, it's nearly impossible to decide what's best for you. Lazarus Naturals pioneered the farm-to-front-door model of transparency where they handle each step of the production process to ensure quality, potency, and consistency. Scannable labels allow you to see the test results of your hemp batch so you can be confident in the safety and quality. Visit LazarusNaturals.com today. Lazarus Naturals, committed to improving your life as well as the world around you. Not available in Idaho, Iowa, or South Dakota.